good idea. I think one thing we can do before Chen comes is I can tell you a little bit about the paper that we are working on.
Okay.
So I put the title of the paper on the Google Doc, but we haven't finished it yet.
Mm-hmm.
Lucado is still running some experiments.
Okay.
But I think the good thing is that paper will be a perfect preliminary work for this proposal.
Okay, that's excellent.
The idea is to study, it's kind of related to your paper with the Ricardo, the ERSS tree, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
By the way, Ricardo and Ricardo are apartment mates, so I'm sure they can talk to each other.
Yeah, I think they are very close.
Okay.
The idea is to find out what kind of virtual machines can. Hi.
Okay.
Yeah, I was just telling
just
about
getting
you.
Started. I'm gonna close this door if you.
Yeah.
Don't.
Yeah. Please. Yeah. It's a big job. And so yeah, daily coffee.
That's only half day.
Not even daily.
Yeah. So we're recording this.
Okay.
Yeah.
So they find out what kind of virtual machines can live happily together on the same core.
On the same core?
And it's more complicated. We started by, originally we wanted to see the performance of two virtual machines on two threads that belong to the same core.
Mm-hmm.
That was our intention. But then it turns out that Ducato's workstation does not have multi-threading.
Oh.
But it's interesting enough, his processor actually has shared I/O cache between two cores.
Mm-hmm.
So he has a quad-core machine, and two pairs of cores. Each pair shared 6 megabytes of I/O cache.
That's a lot. Usually it's L3 sites.
Yeah, so that's a workstation class processor that doesn't have L3, but it has a pretty big L2.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. My other student has i7, which has multi-threads,
mm-hmm.
But we haven't done experiments on that yet. But because of the shared cache, so you can see the same kind of behavior that we want to see on the multi-threaded processor too. So basically, if we have one class of benchmarks which are CPU bound, okay, and another class which is memory bound,
mm-hmm.
right? So if you put two memory bound benchmarks together and on the same pair of cores,
mm-hmm.
okay, then that would significantly increase the cache miss rate,
mm-hmm.
okay. On the other hand, if you put one CPU bound and one memory bound together,
mm-hmm.
then that would bring much lower
mm-hmm.
cache miss rate.
Okay. Sure.
That's pretty much what he's doing now. And the next step, if we get to the point of running experiments on i7, then we could also try to run two CPU bound benchmarks on the same core, okay,
mm-hmm.
using two threads. Okay, then they may cause contention.
On the SMT core.
On
the
SMT core,
mm-hmm.
right? That may cause contention on the ALUs, okay, or floating point units.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but we know that they are yet. So this week, because this paper is due on Friday, so
mm-hmm.
this week I'm pretty much occupied by this paper. But as I said, the results coming out of this paper would be perfect preliminary work for this proposal.
Mm,
okay. We have some interesting results already.
Let me explain to you.
There's several interesting things. Okay, so these are those benchmarks. Okay, so we run these two. This is one. We run them in virtual machines.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So we ping. We run one benchmark per virtual machine, and we ping one virtual machine on the core. Okay, so this belongs to one pair of core.
This is for the single threaded cores.
Yes, single threaded core.
Okay.
They share the L2 cache.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So we first run all of these benchmarks on their own. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So we can profile the cache miss rate, their own cache miss rate, without any
in isolation.
Yeah, in isolation. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So based on that result, okay, we pretty much created two classes. Right? This are the memory bound benchmarks
mm-hmm.
based on the cache miss rate. Okay. So and this actually this is with increasing cache miss rate when they run alone. Okay, this is like 4%, 4%, 6%, 7%, 12%, and 80%. So this one is the most memory intensive
mm.
one. Okay, or cache
where do you read that 80%?
It's not here. There's another page I forgot.
Oh,
to
okay, okay.
Yeah, but now this data are all from the
combined.
Yeah, from the contention already, and these are the CPU bound, okay, based on the cache miss rate when they run alone, okay. So if we focus on the first group, which is EQUIC, which has a 4% cache miss rate when it's run alone, okay.
Mm-hmm.
And then we run it to be the four different kinds of supposedly CPU bound benchmarks,
mm-hmm.
okay. So if it runs with GDIF and GCC, the cache miss rate is very low, okay.
Mm-hmm.
The total combined cache miss rate is around this. Okay, so these two has the cache miss rate of 0% or 1% when
mm-hmm.
they run alone. When they run along
mm-hmm.
along with EQUIC, the cache miss rate is still pretty low.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but the EQUIC so cache miss rate doubles.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the total cache miss rate is like this. Okay,
mm-hmm.
now then the TWOF and ART. Okay,
but that's interesting. I think
yeah,
I mean these guys don't use much cache.
They don't use much cache, yes.
If they're running in isolation.
Right.
And these are cache miss rates for L2, right?
Yes.
So which means, right, they're probably contending on L1. And which is why these guys are using more L2 than
mm-hmm.
before.
Mm-hmm.
No, L1 is isolated.
No,
L1 is separate.
I was
so,
okay.
Basically, for this case, you know what? Yeah. What is time for one, okay?
Yeah.
So only level 2 is here.
Right.
Okay. So this is core 0, this is core 1,
mm-hmm.
this run app 1, this one app, or this one at 0, this one app
1.
Okay. And then they have their level 1.
Yes, yes.
Level 1.
Yes.
So, see, look, only this part is here.
Yeah.
So, for this.
Yeah,
case.
But can you explain why EQUIC's cache miss rate doubles?
They compete for level 2.
Yeah, so they still can pay contention on L2. Even though it's mostly
right.
CPU bound. Right.
This is something that we also observed in the ERSS.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Because of the flooding of the cache
yeah.
by the other application. So
yeah.
although the application does not reuse
right.
items in L2, it does flood L2.
Mm.
Yeah.
That affects the...
Yeah.
the so this is actually... we should work... we should use these versions to... to validate our theories further, but
then,
yeah.
So the interesting thing is all of these are done with virtual machines.
Uh-huh.
So the cache miss rate you see here is combined. It's from both the application, the kernel, the guest
mm-hmm.
kernel, and the part that part of the Zen that is dedicated to that virtual machine.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
That's interesting. So this originally had 4%, you said.
Yes.
And now it's more than double.
Yes.
It's or at least double.
Yeah. Almost doubled, yeah.
Mm.
So now the TWOF and ART are interesting because based on chance simulation results, these two are supposed to be memory bound.
Mm-hmm.
But when we run them alone, they become CPU bound. Okay, and based on his speculation, that's because of prefetching, cache prefetching. Right?
And also that the level 2 cache size.
The size of level 2 cache,
yeah. Level 2 cache size, because
yeah.
in simulation, we normally assume your level 2 cache size is only
yeah.
520K.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
then in this case, it's 6
yeah. megabytes.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I mean, you would be observing
yeah.
much less cache.
Hi.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So you have a quick, long question.
It didn't work. Did you said to include, take off the offset from it before...
Mm-hmm.
using the macros and the same...
I suggest you talk to the EQ. Let me see whether he's in the lab or not. Do you know his lab?
No.
Okay. He's in 283. I tell him that you are coming. Just go there. Okay?
Thank you.
They're in my class too.
Oh, they are?
Yeah. Right now?
Yeah, computer engineering students. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to continue?
Yeah, continue, yes. Right. Then, but still they are quite, they are actually real, still memory bound. Okay. Because when we run them concurrently with another memory bound benchmark,
mm-hmm.
you see their cache miss rate become much higher. When they run alone, their miss rate is 1%, TOF is 0%, ART is 2%. Now they become 7% and 13%.
Mm-hmm.
But the total miss rate is much higher, 16 and 22. Okay.
And that's a huge miss rate, actually.
Yeah, but this is still lower. If you compare to when we run two memory bound together,
mm-hmm.
these numbers here,
mm-hmm.
this one even is more than 50%.
This is on the same hardware?
Same hardware.
Where L1 is.
L2
is shared and L1 is.
Yes.
Okay.
So this is from when we run two memory bound on a pair of cores.
So these are memory bound?
These and this, both.
Both are memory bound.
Okay.
Yeah.
This one is MAP. This one is
CPU. Wait. Okay. Okay. So these are workloads from some benchmark.
It's spec.
From
spec.
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 Yeah. Spec CPU.
Spec CPU 2000.
Yeah.
Is that free, by the way?
It's not free.
It's free for academics.
No,
or?
It's not free for academics.
But
I have my compiler and I have new.
Oh, you have a license for.
I have license.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. That's good to know. Because we were thinking about getting one, but maybe we don't have to.
So it's not very expensive.
No, it's not expensive, but I can.
How much is it?
It's only 100 something.
Oh, that's it?
Less
okay.
than $200.
Oh, okay, okay.
Which is good, right?
Hmm.
So, yeah, that's, so this reveals that these two are actually memory bound. So if you do profiling, you have to do it, cannot just do it alone, you have to run it with somebody.
I think this actually validates some of the work that Ricardo has done
yeah.
with respect to the flooding.
Yeah.
Although, so this is what we call compulsory misses,
mm.
and you probably are familiar with that term.
Mm.
Compulsory misses versus capacity misses.
Right,
if there is reuse, then
yeah.
you can have capacity misses. But if there is no reuse or very little reuse, most of your misses are compulsory misses because you're just accessing once for the first time. You have to go to memory, right? So the compulsory misses for the CPU-intensive workloads are actually flooding the shared L2 cache, which affects the memory-bound process, the miss rate of the memory-bound process.
No, another way I'm trying to say it is not only about compulsory misses. There are two different scenarios. One thing is, okay, yes, it's the first time you use it, you will definitely have a miss. But then this scenario is when you run it too. We briefly touched this during the day discussion. So when you run it two different applications, it's a confliction misses.
Conflict misses.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Sure.
Conflict.
When you look at both, then the misses in the memory bound application are because of conflict.
Yeah.
But the misses in the CPU-bound application are compulsory misses.
No, the thing
and
is...
What I'm trying to say is that because of the compulsory misses, you're introducing conflict misses in the other process.
No,
because the compulsory misses still occupy cache. You need to bring it into the cache, and now you may be evicting something from the other guy's capacity.
Yes.
And
yeah.
so you increase the capacity misses for the first process. Which is memory bound.
Okay. Yeah. To some degree, yes.
Yeah.
It's both.
I mean, the way I see it is that the capacity misses of the first process now increase because of the flooding of the cache due by the second process. Earlier, the capacity misses were much lower because there was no flooding of the cache.
Mm-hmm. But anyway, the thing is for Lucas, it's still too high.
Lucas has 18% on its own.
Yeah.
Right. So then, yeah. So, well, that also explains, right? Even for equity doubles, right? So for Lucas, it's almost it doubles too.
What I don't understand though is why the miss rate of this CPU bound increase, because you're saying that some of them are not really CPU bound, they are memory bound.
No, for this case, it's just relative.
Uh-huh.
It's all relative.
Yeah.
Relative to their level 2 cache miss rate.
Mm.
So basically, what we define is anybody has less than 1% level 2 cache miss rate as memory bound, as CPU bound.
Mm-hmm.
And then larger than that, we define them as memory bound. So it's not really like you don't access level 2 at all. It's just how frequent you're missing in the cache.
The L1 or
L2?
L2. Right, but what I'm thinking is that...
And
that
means data a little bit from us, a little bit different from us, because anyway, always simulator based. That means it's really running on the real hardware.
But what if you... I mean, I'm assuming that it would be fairly straightforward to change the size of L2 from 512 KB to 6 megabytes.
Yeah.
In your simulator.
Yeah, I can easily see that.
And
then
see if they match with this. You know.
But then you will see that... then that only justifies the difference between the simulator design and the real hardware.
Right.
That doesn't provide any insight functional information, because that's just if your behavior is totally different from the real hardware, then it just means that your simulator is the accuracy is in doubt.
Right. I mean, that's...
But if they are uniform to each other, well, that's good. That's validate that. Yeah.
All I'm saying is that for you to compare the simulator versus the real system,
yeah,
the configuration
should
at the very minimum
has
to be the same.
Yeah, has to be the same. Yeah,
right.
Really same.
And then if there are differences, then there are other reasons for those differences.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we are all comparing that.
Mm-hmm.
His work is just a starting point. But in the end, we use the real data.
So I think this part also goes into the middleware. I mean, at least the way I see it is to inform the OS scheduler as to how to map VMs to cores.
Mm.
Right.
Yeah. So there are still many more experiments that we need to do beyond this. So if we can finish all of them, we should have very good preliminary work. Okay.
Right, and the other thing I think is that, I mean, what we haven't talked about in the proposal yet, which I would like to start expanding, is to acknowledge that the hardware is sort of hierarchical and not completely homogeneous.
Mm.
Some cores, some pairs of cores are different than other pairs of cores. So if you take a nearby core, which shares an L2, versus a faraway core which does not share an L2, the conflicts for two applications running in these two pairs of cores will be different, right? So I think it is in that case good for the OS to be aware of that and map VMs to these two different kinds of pairs of cores in the right way, right? So I think that this data also helps to make that point. In the same, it would be good if Delgado and this can run this same set of experiments, but now use faraway cores, which means that they do not share an L2, and then see what happens to the L2 miss rate. If he can do that, I think that would be interesting.
Yeah, but you can imagine there will be no contention on the R2 cache.
Right, but that's a good thing to show, right?
Mm.
But that's a correspondence of different scenario.
Mm.
Is for this one, what we call multi-programming, right? The two independent applications running, right?
Yeah.
So, and what you are saying is, okay, right? Core 2, core 3.
Yeah.
So, level 2, core 4, core 5.
Right.
Level 2, Core 6, core 7, right?
Yeah.
So, and then they are
hypertransport. I don't know what that is called.
Yeah. So they are connected, right?
Yeah.
So if you are running, so for this case, is F0 and F1 have no
independent. Yeah.
Right. And then they only for L2 they only contention.
Mm-hmm.
You only can introduce contention.
True.
Because they share.
Mm-hmm.
But then you move F1 over there,
mm-hmm.
Well, then you don't have contention.
Right.
which is good,
mm-hmm.
which is what you want,
mm-hmm.
right? And then, however, if you share a multi-threaded,
mm-hmm.
which means they share the data, then for this case, it's good,
mm-hmm.
because you want to share the data.
Yes.
But if you want, if you put app 1 there, then it's not good.
That's
because you introduce the overhead. Now they share the data, and they need to communicate in between these two levels to cache conflicts.
Yes.
Is that what you mean?
I didn't mean that, but that's a very good point. I was thinking about applications that are independent in the data that they access.
Yeah,
right.
We actually can see that in virtual machines, right?
So, but even for virtual machines, you can have multiple threads inside the virtual machine.
Inside the same virtual machine.
Inside the same virtual machine that would likely share some data.
Yes, but then that becomes more sensible to give closer calls to the same virtual machine.
Not always, so it depends on what you're running inside the virtual machine. If
they're
sharing, then...
Yeah, but the scheduling is the entity that we are scheduling at middleware level.
Right.
We don't care of the internal scheduling instead of the virtual machine.
Mm.
So if there's contention, then there's contention. We don't care about that. Do we? Do we care about that?
So you're saying that the VM, the hypervisor cannot schedule processes inside virtual machine.
And there's an assumption that we run one application per virtual machine, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a reasonable assumption.
Right.
Right. But the application
can be multi-threaded.
Can be multi-threaded, and it could either be that the threads share data or they don't.
Right.
And in these two different cases, you probably want to treat them differently.
Yeah. I would think it'd be more likely that
they
share,
right?
That
they share.
Like a web server. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is likely that they share data. But it could also be that they share a very small amount of data in which the cache coherence overhead is lower than the conflict overhead. And if they are two threads, they're probably very similar, which means they're not complementary in their behavior. If they're two threads, they're both either going to be CPU bound or both going to be memory bound if they're doing exactly the same thing. Like a web server, right? If I create two web server threads, they're both going to do approximately the same behavior, right? And they're either going to be both CPU bound or they're both going to be memory bound. So in that case, they probably should not be put on the same core.
I think if somebody programming and somebody threading, if the programmer is doing a good job, then he should use multi-threading when the thread needs to share data. Otherwise, he should use multi-programming, right? If it's multi-programming, then that means he's actually running multiple programs, independent applications.
Well, not necessarily. I mean, the programmers are, in the end, looking at application-level programmers, are not really thinking about contention at the multi-core and SMT level, right? They are thinking about what is the easiest way to write programs and debug them.
No, I'm talking about from the programming level.
Right.
So there are two programming models.
Right.
One is multi-threading and the other is multi-programming.
No.
One is multi-program. One is parallel program.
No.
They all correspond to multi-thread because in the end...
I'm talking about software multi-threading. When you use p-thread, for instance.
I understand your point.
Yeah.
But it's possible that even though the processes or the threads, the threads share data, they only share a really small amount of data. Right? In which case, it might be acceptable to pay the price of the cache coherence overhead and gain the benefit of coupling two complementary behaviors on the same core.
I understand. I'm just trying to figure out the likelihood of that.
The likelihood of that is the following.
Yeah.
That I mean, if I run a multi-threaded web server, then what the thread share is access to a data structure that manages the thread pool, maybe some minimum amount of data structure to allow synchronization, right? Maybe one lock.
But they would also share the web pages, right? They would be working on the same set of web pages.
Right, but the web page is DMA, right? They don't go through the cache, right? It's I/O. They don't touch cache at all.
Mm.
Talking about the core and
the
memory data that the processes use. It would be good. I think it's a really good exercise for us to understand what is better in such a case. I mean, if you have a benchmark web server and if we can map two threads of the web server to two different.
Or at least they have, they would be pretty much the same program, right? So the instructions would be the same.
The instructions, yes, they would share. That's true.
Mm.
The instructions would be shared.
Mm.
That's a good point, yeah. But it's not immediately obvious to me.
Yeah,
that that's what
I know. I know. Yeah, I'm just trying to figure it out with you. Yeah. Okay. Anyway. Yeah, I agree, but I think that's just one.
One specific case.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
And yeah. Yeah. If first of all, if we need to figure out the virtual machine that we're scheduling, and then if there's room, we can go inside of the virtual machine, and even just it's a mass, it's cross core scheduling for a single virtual machine. Even.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I agree. I think Roger's point is that we need to recognize the inherent heterogeneity in a multi-core architecture.
Mm-hmm.
With different cores, they share different things. They have different behaviors, and if the system software is aware of that, then the mapping of virtual machines through the cores can be optimized.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, I don't know if you got a chance, maybe you might have a chance to look at the multi-kernel paper.
Yeah. Which is the one you're talking about, this one? Or maybe different one?
No.
Different one.
Multi-kernel,
what's the name?
Multi-kernel.
Just multi-kernel?
Yeah. Multi-kernel, where they run one OS instance per core.
Is that the...
Where everything, nothing is shared, everything
no,
is...
No, not the OSDI paper? Or?
That's the Eurosys paper.
Multi-kernel.
Yes.
The reason I... From where? From
Eurosys.
Microsoft Research.
Also ETH, Zurich.
A new OS architecture for scalable multi-core system. So what they did?
Their idea is to not share anything across cores. Every core runs its own OS.
So it's not decompose a single OS.
Not decompose a single OS. It's a replicated, that's why they call it multi-kernel, because there are actually one kernel per core.
But I haven't read it, but do they have to statically allocate memory?
Statically allocate memory? No.
No?
No. Because they have MPI, messages that are being communicated across these kernels to coordinate access to physical resources.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
And there they talk about the heterogeneity aspect, where even within a single chip,
yes,
like that,
yeah,
you have cores that are very, there are different kinds of pairs of cores.
Yeah.
And then across chips, there is different level of sharing.
Mm.
And then there are cores which are dedicated for certain functionality, including FPGA cores, including some, not FPGA cores, but FPGA chips, which can run their own thing. If you want to use that FPGA chip within the system, then you probably want to run an OS on that chip and run, because that chip runs a different instruction set. You have a GPU, which runs a different instruction set, but then the multi-kernel can figure out how to map different applications to different chips and different cores, depending on which cores are the best suited for the job.
Yeah, that belongs to the totally different platform.
It's a different platform. That's becoming more mainstream, this sort of platform.
Those guys, okay. Yeah, they did. This kind of research, I think the European research is mainly, is a favorite topic for them. Because they are mainly looking at the heterogeneous multi-core platform, and they always think, I have seen design like, okay, now, we have multi-cluster, and what is each cluster? Each cluster consists of a traditional microprocessor and a GPU plus an FPGA. So it's three of them form the cluster, and multiple of them together, then we have a whole heterogeneity platform. And then how? This should be our future. But what we are targeting,
I'm saying that even in mainstream processor is still heterogeneous just by looking at that. Not all cores are the same because some cores share some resources,
yeah,
whereas other cores do not.
Yes.
And there's heterogeneity from that viewpoint, right? Which is what these guys are also talking about.
Okay.
There are some cores which are SMT, there may be other cores which are not, right?
Yeah.
On the same platform. And so their argument is that you want to build a multi-kernel where you run one OS instance for a specific core based on how the core looks like,
mm,
and what the sharing for that core looks like.
Mm.
It's an interesting direction.
Mm.
I think they make a good case.
Yeah, I agree.
The main argument is that the main difference between existing OS and the multi-kernel is that everything is replicated, nothing is shared across cores.
Mm.
And if there is some data that needs to be shared, the manipulation of shared data is through messages across cores.
Mm.
So that's really their main pitch.
I agree in the sense that there are certainly things that we can learn from this approach,
mm-hmm,
even for such a not so heterogeneous architecture. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So I thought about this, even though I haven't read about this paper, but I thought about this. I think in the second layer, if there's anything that we can do, the virtual machine marathon layer, right? As we discussed last time, the main overhead introduced by virtual machine monitor is memory virtualization and I/O virtualization, right?
Mm.
So if we can decentralize the I/O virtualization and memory virtualization,
mm,
okay, so say for instance each virtual machine has its own page for handler and I/O virtualization handler.
Right.
Then that could reduce the contention.
Right.
And also improve the accountability.
That's one.
Yeah.
That's one way. The other way, I think, is that groups of virtual machines share some service, right?
Mm.
Groups of virtual machines can share a memory manager.
Yes.
And you have multiple memory managers, which you can have them communicate with each other to let's say repartition or reassign the physical memory.
Yes.
Are ideas that already exist, right? I mean, we're just borrowing that for virtual machines. I mean, these guys do that, and then the L4
mm.
microkernel did that several years back. So those idea of having per group of process or per, now it would be per group of VM resource managers, is an existing.
I agree.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. If there's a novelty, the novelty would be how to do that in a virtual machine architecture.
Yeah.
I agree.
Yeah.
So by the way, can you provide some pointers to the papers just mentioned? The L4 and the
other L4 it's the L4 microkernel. There are two papers. One is called On Microkernel Construction.
Okay,
that's the first one.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a very, very old paper, 95 SOSP. Yeah.
Mm.
And the other one is called Full Performance of Microkernel. Yeah. Go to Scholar.
This one?
No. Yes, the performance of microkernel based systems. That's the one.
This one?
Yes.
View kernel?
Yes.
View kernel system.
Mm-hmm. Oh. That's the presentation, but that's the paper.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Got it. Those are the two papers.
Well, both are. Yes, both are.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right. I think the first one is on, describes L3, which is the predecessor of L4.
Okay.
And the second one, the performance of microkernel. No, this is not the paper I'm thinking about. But this one too, and there's another one I think which appeared in 2003 SOSP or something like that. Can you look at some of them? Hold on. I'll send you the link.
Sure.
It'll be easier because
I'd like to read the papers and think about it and see whether there's any indeed any new contribution we can make.
In that paper, they also talk about L4 Linux.
Okay.
Where they virtualize Linux on a microkernel.
The paper you got sent me.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good. Okay. So. All right. So. Do you have any other comments?
Yeah, I guess the message across the lesson shared memory, which is a very good point, because from hardware point of view, since when you have more than a dozen cores, hardware
will invalidate everything.
Hardware assisted memory
core.
Because you do shared memory, right?
Yeah.
So then hardware-assisted shared memory, the overhead is simply too huge, which means it doesn't scale. Then you're looking at 100 cores or 1,000 cores, then the only way to do that is through message bus.
Yeah. Right. So their point, I mean, that's a very good point, and we discussed this in class too, is that when you have, let's say you have multiple threads, they're all sharing something, and they're all sitting in different, they all share, they're isolated in terms of cache, but the cache needs to be coherent.
Mm-hmm.
So if someone does an update, everybody else's cache gets invalidated.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So that invalidation operation has a huge latency to invalidate, and that is a synchronous operation
mm-hmm.
when you write to the cache.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a serious performance problem. I think they have a figure here. And some data which is just amazing. So they say that on a single core, if you're modifying the same data, it takes 30 cycles. But when you're modifying one data item on 16 cores, it takes 12,000 cycles. Because you need to invalidate all the caches on the 16 cores. And instead of doing that, if you were to explicitly communicate using messages, it's going to be much cheaper.
Yeah. And that's exactly what Intel did, because Intel produced this prototype chip,
mm-hmm.
48 core,
mm-hmm.
and they didn't do hardware memory coherency.
Mm-hmm.
It's up to the programmer to specify the memory coherency.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's from a software level, so
mm-hmm.
they didn't do
it. How is message passing down in the end?
In the end, it would be through shared memory.
Mm.
But you're not talking about all cores sharing the same data.
Right.
You'll have a different pipe to each core.
Right.
And so all the cores do not share the same pipe, which makes it completely different. Because then you'll have to invalidate only one core instead of all 16 or 100 cores.
Right. So people are talking about the hypertransport. That's for cache coherence or?
Largely, yeah. Cache coherence.
Mm.
Yeah, that's basically for cache coherence, right? The hypertransport.
No, I don't know what is hypertransport.
It's the high bandwidth core to core.
High bandwidth hypertransport link. Core to core links. It's also, I think, for interprocessor interrupts, IPIs. So if one core wants to send a processor interrupt to some other core.
What's that for?
That's for having the core handle an interrupt. Similar to what you would get from a device, but instead it is from a different core. It can be used for message passing, for instance. If you want to do synchronous message passing, you can write to the shared memory, have an IPI, and then the other core will look it up and send you back an acknowledgement. Yeah. So that would also use the hypertransfer.
So then how does message passing or in this case is affecting our proposal?
how does it affect our proposal? I don't know. I have to think about that. But they, this paper makes a very good point, which is that, you know, building or structuring operating systems based on the shared memory abstraction or having a single instance of the OS is no longer the obviously right direction to go, because there are all these other problems, right? Which is why they explore this alternate multi-kernel architecture where there is no one instance, but there are one instance per core, and the state is completely replicated instead of being shared.
How does this compare to that? I only run the operating system or virtual machine monitor on several cores. I only dedicate a specific number of cores to run the system software. I only run the system software there.
How does this compare to that?
Right.
Well, if they share something, then and you bound the footprint on the hardware, then the coherence overhead is going to be limited by the footprint of the shared code on the hardware. So let's say that I enforce that my OS is only going to run on core 0 and core 1.
Yeah.
Then the coherence overhead is 0.
Right.
Because they share all the cache.
Right.
Well, there is some coherence between L1 and L1, but that I don't know how much, how, whether that can be, that would be a dominant factor because L1 is small.
Right.
But if you, let's say you restrict your, let's say this is a multi-chip, so it's multi-processor system,
right.
And there are 4 cores or something. In this case,
8 cores
per processor, and you say, okay, I'm going to run the OS only on one processor,
right?
And on 8 cores of that one processor,
right.
Then the cache coherence overhead is limited to the coherence overhead across these 4 L2 caches, and because of these 4 L2 caches being on the same chip or being on the same processor, the coherence will be lower than the coherence between 2 cores on 2 different processors.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So certainly restricting the footprint to a much smaller hardware area is going to limit the amount of cache coherence overhead.
But that's different than what they are proposing, right?
Yes,
it is different. They are proposing to run a different kernel on every core, right?
Yeah. They are proposing more generic architecture and solution, which does not assume anything about the workload.
Mm. Yeah. But I guess what I meant, both are possible.
Can we do both? Yeah. I mean, possibly. We could run, let's say, one instance per processor instead of one instance per core. One OS instance per processor.
Mm.
And then although multiple threads in that processor will share data,
right.
the amount of cache coherence overhead to share that data is limited.
Mm.
Right. So you could do something along that direction. But if there are more and more cores per processor, at some point they're arguing that even on the same chip, the interconnect across cores is going to get really complex.
Mm.
And there will be hierarchy even within a substantial hierarchy even within a single chip.
Right.
Because when you want to put, let's say, 100 cores on a chip, then you cannot make interconnects that are simple. The interconnects are naturally going to be more complex.
Mm.
And then there has to be hierarchy. And then it would not be a good idea to run a single instance even for one chip. You probably want to do something more fine-grained.
Right. Right.
Right. Okay. So, looking back at its outline, seems to me that one comes to 3 layers. Let me see what. I think the third layer is somehow the same as the first layer after the of this one you guys revised it.
Yeah.
Let's see.
I didn't really quite revise the third.
Yeah, I didn't quite. Yeah, I didn't either. So, what I'm saying is that
maybe I did.
What I'm saying is like the resource management. Then you, I mean, in this layer, you're talking about the same thing. You're talking about a cross layer, then, but you manage the same resource. That's a confusion to
no,
me.
Oh, I see. So the difference is at middleware layer or any software layer, we don't do any scheduling at the hardware layer. We just use the knowledge about the hardware layer to optimize the software layer scheduling.
Yeah.
In the multi-kernel paper, they do talk about that. They do, not the knowledge. They talk about a different kind of knowledge base later on in the paper, where the OS is aware of the topology of the hardware.
Which it should.
Because there can be different, they're arguing that there are different kinds of topologies.
Yeah.
And Intel topology, even within Intel, you have many different choices. Within AMD, there's different choices. If the OS is aware of that topology, it can use, and the properties of the different components in the topology, the OS can use that information to do more interesting things.
Right. Yeah, that's what the OS is supposed to be able to
do. But that's not the case.
That's not what it does today.
No.
Yeah, because right now we're just going to multiple.
Yeah.
Right. So it's so one thing gets more complex, and that's what you feed those information to the back to the OS.
But I think that, I mean, similarly to that, there are opportunities for OS to make a lot of research in virtual machine monitors. I think you have to deal with similar problems.
Right.
Then it's the OS is running inside the virtual machine, right?
But the guest OS does not really face so many cores, right? Guest OS is just dealing with still small number of cores.
Yeah. Usually the guest OS will span a subset of the physical cores.
Who designed that?
The virtual machine monitor.
Virtual machine monitor. Yeah.
Virtual machine monitor. If let's say I'm running four virtual machines.
Yes.
The virtual machine monitor could assign core 0 and core 1 to VM1, core 2 and core 3 to VM2, and so on. It can partition the physical resources across the virtual machine.
Are we targeting at the data center?
In this proposal?
Yeah.
I would think so, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That would make sense.
And so then the thing is, then it's a user. The user.
The administrator.
No. Aside from the so the user buys this service, right? In terms of number of cores, memory and the hard and the storage, and the user buy that, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that means
that's only one model. That's the cloud.
Cloud model. Yeah.
Cloud.
Yeah. I'm constraining myself to cloud model. So maybe.
Right, but I don't see why we had to constrain ourselves to the cloud model. We could also look at a more traditional data center.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah,
traditional data center is administrator.
Yes. So the administrator, even in the cloud data center, the administrator has a very significant role to play because he gets to decide, for instance, which core is a virtual machine. He can decide that.
Yeah.
I don't know if he does that today, but he can decide which cores in some physical host does a certain virtual machine get.
Yeah. So even when you go to the cloud buy processors, you don't know where they are really, right? So that is transparent with the user.
So then basically I think from one of the assumptions we made is we don't touch that because we assume that we only look at a limited set of physical resources, now for this case a single server, for example.
We can go beyond that if we did.
But okay. Anyway, so let's see. We focus on this first. We assume that this virtual machine with their applications being assigned here already.
Exactly.
And
then in the proposal, I did mention that is maybe there is some centralized resource manager, and each host can provide hints to the central manager to inform the central manager that some virtual machines are not compatible. and you might want to move some of, you know, a few of them off to a different physical host. I think we could do in that direction, but I think we, if we target all, most of the proposals towards a single physical machine, then we have to make the argument that that's already difficult, substantial amount of work to just that problem itself, right? And in a way, it's good because then the proposal is more focused. It's not like all over the place. The reader is also, as a consequence, gets more focused on what we're talking about. Then the only constraint is that we have to convince the reader that this is a substantial problem.
Yeah,
right. Whereas, that it's sufficient for a 3-year project.
Yeah.
And it is good enough to look at this, just this problem, because independently, as long as there is some communication between, you know, what's going on in a single post and with what's going on in some central decision making.
Right.
And so your first layer is a middleware layer, right?
Uh-huh.
So you said the middleware layer runs in between user application and system software. Right.
Right.
So, which means then, am I right if I say middleware run in between the user application and the guest operating system?
Not really, because middleware is also user space.
It's also one level layer. It's like between the guest operating system and the virtual machine.
Yeah, let me try to draw what you're saying.
Yeah.
And so, I think I can erase this, right?
Yeah.
So we have multiple cores on one host, right? So in this case, let's say that we have
a
group. We're running 4 VMs.
Okay.
On these 8 cores. So I could have VM 0 here, VM 1 running here, VM 2 running here, VM 3 running here, and I could have the middleware running here, running on these two cores. That's one possibility.
Okay.
In each core, in each VM, I have guest OS.
Yeah.
And
user application.
Yeah, application. There's another guest OS and application and so on. In the middleware layer also, I have an OS. And I have middle running here.
Where is the virtual machine monitor?
The virtual machine monitor schedules all these. It's like,
where
if I had to put it somewhere, I'd put it here.
Yeah.
This is a virtual machine monitor. It manages all the cores.
But
it schedules cores to
where you actually run it.
The virtual machine monitor is not a. This is something which I tell my OS students.
Yeah.
Don't think of the OS as a process.
Okay.
Think of the OS as an event-driven system.
Mm. Event-driven system.
It's an event-driven system. It does things in response to certain events in the system, such as requests from guests or requests from devices. So the virtual machine monitor can actually run its code on any of these cores at any given point. So, for instance, inside on this core, right, this middleware can have multiple threads. Well, actually, this is not a good example, perhaps. Yeah, well, fine. Multiple threads. If one of these threads, that's not good either. Actually, what I need is multiple guests. Okay. I can map multiple guests to the same core,
yes.
Right?
Okay.
If one of the, and I need to do time sharing across
okay.
the guests
okay.
for that core,
yeah.
And the virtual machine monitor will handle the timer interrupts, the APIC events from the core and say, okay, now it's time to schedule a different guest on the same core. So it runs on the same core as the guest.
No, then from what I get is, the virtual machine monitoring is not a centralized process, but it's more like a distributed process.
It is. It's not a process.
But it's not a process, but it's a distributed.
It's a distributed entity.
It can be but the thing is, the virtual machine monitor itself, it's a software.
It is
layer.
Software. Yes.
So where is it physically?
Well, it depends on what do you mean, where does it run, or where is its memory footprint?
So the both.
So its memory footprint is in main memory, it's in DRAM,
any
other software.
Then why so?
Where does it run? It
so
depends on which core
triggers it.
Yeah, it runs right there.
But why is that? I mean,
in some hypervisors, it's always that the event handling of the, for instance, device interrupts is always on core zero.
Okay.
So the device driver code of the virtual machine monitor will always run in those cases on core zero.
Okay.
But in other hypervisors, any core can get an interrupt.
I see.
And it depends on the processor support as well.
I see. Okay. So that makes sense, because it's like whenever you have an interrupt, then you just go directly to the
hypervisor.
So it's not like a hypervisor. It's like whenever you have a system interrupt, then you would go get the data, get the instruction to handle a certain system interruption. So then for this case, virtual machine monitor just another interrupt. So then you go there and grab the instruction over for the virtual machine monitor to handle that. Yeah.
And this is not as simple though, because I mean, those are for device interrupts, but there are also software interrupts, like system calls.
Yeah. Okay.
And then in those cases, it depends on whether the solution is para-virtualization
or
full system virtualization.
Yeah.
And in these two cases, and there are also many kinds of intermediate kinds of virtualization between these two extremes.
I see. Okay.
And in some cases, system call is already translated into a regular function call, which is called a hyper call. And those sorts of not necessarily. You had to translate the system call into a regular function call, that invokes the guest OS core.
Okay.
Right? So there are lots of possibilities there.
So that if it's full virtualized, if it's a trap, the hypervisor run on the system call where the trap happens, or it can still be routed to the first core.
So in that case, it has to run on the same core.
Right.
Yeah, because all the state is on that core.
Yes.
But I'm talking about device interrupts.
How
and hardware interrupts go to
that the operating system configure that?
How does the hypervisor configure that?
Right. Or that's how hardware configures it.
I think it's a choice that you can make to when you maybe a BIOS setting of some kind to say that all device interrupts go to core.
Yeah, I always have that question.
Yeah.
Mm. Okay. But the, another thing to look at is just like when you non-virtualized system, kernel is always part of a process's memory footprint. So like in the hypervisor is also always part of the guest process is part of the higher memory, or lower memory, lower maybe.
Low memory.
Yeah.
So the hypervisor is mapped into the process memory, virtual memory.
Okay.
Yeah. And the guest OS is also mapped into each process virtual memory.
Okay.
So this is to avoid, for instance, TLB flushes.
Okay.
Because the same, if you're switching from one guest to another guest, the hypervisor TLB entries are shared because it's exactly in the same place in both virtual address space for these two guests, right? Guest processes.
So to go back to Chen's question, about middleware runs, so runs between application and the system server only conceptually, okay? But you can see here,
right?
And if you did, you can also run a daemon, say, instead of the guest OS, if you say you want to collect information within the guest OS, and that daemon, you also consider that as part of the middleware.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Okay. So, yeah.
Yeah. No, go ahead.
So it seems to me all the three layers,
the layer that at least Roger and I have the best handle is the middleware layer, and most of our academic work are in that layer.
Mm.
Now in the virtual machine model layer, I need to read more.
Yeah.
You know, read the papers and really think about whether there's any distribution that we can make, and that has to be specific to multi-core.
I think for sure there's some new things that we should use at the moment, right?
I believe so, yeah. Virtual machine model is very different from microkernel.
Mm-hmm.
I believe so. So, but I need to do more research on that. Okay.
Then in the hardware layer, I'm not sure whether what you did before is sufficient or you need to propose new things. Or
for me, it's more like what I'm thinking is more like what, not what I propose something new. It's how about those, how can we connect across these two layers? Or
three layers.
Yeah, or three layers. It's not like, I think the whole idea or concept is not like you're doing this on this layer, you're doing this on that layer, I'm doing this on that layer, then put together. It's more like...
I agree. There's a connection, but the thing is, if I say this proposal has some new contribution in terms of architectural design, right, then there has to be some new ideas from the architectural, point of view, right? So it's not just a supporting role. It has to have some new ideas. And then, so we have new ideas at each one of these three layers, and all of these ideas have to be connected, obviously.
So what about, I mean, these heterogeneous cores, can we think of some kind of a standardized hardware interface across heterogeneous cores that provide some information about contention at the core level? Assuming that cores are very different from each other, some cores are highly SMT, some cores are not, some cores are GPUs. Can we have some sort of a common hardware interface for the hypervisor to tap information about the core, the dynamics of the resources inside each core, and how they're getting utilized? I remember that last meeting we talked about, for instance, exposing some information about core resource utilization.
Yeah.
Can we standardize that somehow across different kinds of cores? Maybe even to expose that information, there needs to be some, maybe even if we assume homogeneous cores,
mm-hmm.
to expose that information or to collect and summarize that information, there may be some innovation in hardware that's necessary. I don't know. I'm just guessing. So, I mean, even something very simple as if I have an SMT core, how do I expose information to the virtual machine monitor that will inform the virtual machine monitor that there is resource underutilization at the SMT core? Even something, you know, binary values is underutilized or sufficiently utilized. But then we could make it even more interesting, much more interesting than that. I don't know if that's the right direction to go into.
Thank you.
there is some challenges there to expose some such information. Maybe even just the process of exposing some information is a challenge.
Yeah, I don't know.
What?
Just exporting information to a virtual machine monitor. Even I don't know if that. Just that is challenging.
For instance, for memory bound applications or virtual machines, we can collect cache miss.
Yeah.
Yeah. Most processors are already powered by that.
Mm. Yeah.
But how about say the contention on ALUs?
Mm.
How do we know about that? How do I know we should not run two integer intensive operating, you know, computing intensive virtual machines on the same core, right? How do I know about it? You wouldn't know that until we run it and get the final runtime, right? If we have to make a decision
based on an online fashion.
Yeah, how do we do that?
How do I know that, for instance, my performance can be better? Because when I run something on a piece of hardware, I don't know what to expect in terms of performance.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Can the hardware tell me that you can actually do better?
Yeah, something like cache miss. If I know that...
well, the cache miss already...
But that's
only something like cache miss. If I know that I have an integer instruction that is stored for a while because somebody else is using that.
That only happens when you're running multiple threads at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Yes, this is
the
SMT
core.
SMT core, right?
Yeah.
Because if you, I think we discussed that briefly this morning.
Mm.
I give you a physical core.
Mm.
That's the best you can do with all the resources.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Sure. If it's only one thread.
If it's only one thread.
Yeah.
You just, in that case, your main most probably your performance limitation is limited by the inherent parallelism of the application itself.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you run multiple threads,
uh-huh.
then you have the contention for the resources
right.
in the pattern,
yeah.
then you can do a lot of things.
Yeah.
Right.
You can, there's a lot of things you can
yes.
do. And so in terms of in terms of your question, I think last time we touched this little bit, I said, okay, instead of saying memory bound or computation bound, we can see issue bound or commit bound.
Mm. But, you know, from another perspective, okay, I understand what you meant. But from another perspective, even just for the same CPU bound application, they may have different behaviors, right? One is integer, the other is a floating point, for instance. Right? If we run one integer application with the floating point application together, they may be okay. That may be okay. But if I run two floating point together, there may be more contention. Correct? I don't know.
Of course.
Yeah.
That's natural. That's very natural.
Right. So that means if we know. If the software knows that there's such contention, then we should avoid
right.
scheduling like this.
I think the point is that the software may not know what it's doing.
So the thing for us is like obvious. I mean, it's a very. I mean, at least you should know this is a floating point or this
no.
is a.
How do I know? Unless I analyze the instructions.
No, because virtual machines can run whatever they have.
Yeah.
They can be running all kinds of different things.
Okay.
You think about cloud, for instance. Someone comes in with a virtual machine. You don't know what they have in there.
Yeah.
You know they have instructions, but you don't know what kind of instructions.
So, yeah.
What other virtual machine,
yeah.
you don't know what kind of instructions. You run them on the same SMT core,
okay.
and everything blows up. Because not blows up, but everything is super slow. But you don't know why it's slow, unless some additional information is available.
Okay.
And that is not in terms of L2Misses. If L2Misses look good, right? But there's something else going on that the software has no idea about. It.
That's only one thing. And the other thing is the differentiation and the order virtual machine monitor is not even aware of the multi-threading.
Right?
How do I know that the two virtual machines are the same core using different threads? Even that is transparent to the system software.
Yeah, that's I acknowledge it, because you the only thing from the only thing exposed to the software layer is you know that you have these many physical processors, but the in terms of hardware, your hardware implementation, that software doesn't know the details actually.
Right.
SMT only happens at hardware level, then the software level doesn't aware of that.
Yeah.
No, those kind of things, of course, we can provide. I mean, I don't see any difficulty in doing that.
The thing is, how that needs to go in the proposal. Yeah, it's how to generalize this from an architectural point of view, how to generalize this. Not just the specific examples, but make it more general. I don't know.
What do you mean more general?
Make it more general and anonymized. For instance, L2Vision doesn't tell me anything about what is the logic of the application except that it is memory bound. Similarly, you have to have anonymized summary information that tells me that gives the virtual machine monitor enough information about what the virtual machine, how the virtual machine is using processor, core resources in an SMT core, right? And so the hypervisor can make the correct scheduling decision.
But then it's like when I provide you with mixed information, how do you digest?
What mixed information?
So first of all, I provide you with information saying this is based on their level 2 cache misses,
mm-hmm.
right? They have different behavior, right? And then I see this this is a floating point versus integer, different behavior. Then I see this is issue bound. This is commit bound, different behavior. So you had all these different information. Now, how does the system software digest and come out with all this solution? Come out with a solution, because this corresponds different parameters.
Sure. I mean, that's where the hardware software cooperation would come in, right? Once you provide this information,
uh-huh.
then it's up to the software to determine how to use that information.
Yeah.
And to use that information, it could also, although you're providing the information, you could also specify how to use that information and what to do in software, right? Say, okay, here's an algorithm that uses all this information and tells you whether two VMs should be co-located or not on the same SMT core, right? You could come up with that algorithm. No one does that today, which is why I'm saying that could be part of our proposal.
So then I would say,
it's just a yes-no kind of, or what-if kind of question, where you're answering the question, what if these two VMs run on the same SMT core?
Mm-hmm.
What would happen? You're not saying, okay, schedule them together, because within a single, you could also do scheduling based on this information, right? At the software level, where you have control over all cores in the system.
The other point is what I put there for the hardware layer is if the hardware can provide more, either stronger isolation or more control knobs, okay, that may help the software, the virtual machine monitors, to provide the better performance guarantees.
Say that again. What is that?
Because the solution I put there.
Redesign architectures for strong isolation. Yeah.
I don't know whether that's still new or not. So I remember there's a paper that's about that, right? And I don't know that somebody I know is doing that. Is if we can partition cache, for instance, right? That's something has already been done, at least in research for a while. And they also mentioned that, like for SMT. At least for Intel, hypothreading the queues are already partitioned, right? The issue bandwidth is not partitioned.
No.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of that line, along that line, there may be things that hardware can do to offer stronger isolation for concurrent virtual machines. Okay.
What do you mean isolation?
Isolation means isolation, you know, so reduce contention between virtual machines.
Okay, so
okay.
Isolation means
yeah.
Reduce contention.
Just for you know, like a resource allocation, right? I can allocate memory capacity, I can allocate.
I see. For example, I based on the behavior of the thread itself, then my hardware can do some adaptive resource partition, which is along the work that I have done, right?
Mm.
We could also feedback this information because there's we could also feedback this information if that's what you want.
Now feedback means feeding in. Okay. Allow virtual machine monitor to control those maybe hardware level scheduling decisions.
No. Well, I'm not talking about scheduling.
Uh-huh.
I'm not because most of the time that hardware because we try to be autonomous by ourselves.
I think Ming, that's probably too fine-grained.
Yeah.
And the virtual machine monitors probably, first of all, maybe they don't want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And second, it may not even be feasible to control
yeah.
the hardware at that level.
At that level,
that
I agree. I agree.
I don't know, but like for cache, that certainly makes sense.
Right.
For shared cache.
For shared cache,
yeah.
Yes.
Right.
If there is an isolation, then even so, you need to know how much to allocate. In terms of the cache.
Right.
Right. So
then we can do modeling. We can do all the.
Well, then you can use ERS as a model to
yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
How much your cache
yeah.
is. But what I'm saying is, at the pipeline level, those things normally is not controlled by system software. We did ourselves. That's why I'm saying autonomous. Right? So behind the scene, you are not aware of. Then I try to my best. But in that case, the resource I can play with are very limited.
Mm-hmm.
I have predefined resources.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing I can do is adjust correspondingly, dynamically, according
mm-hmm.
to the threads of behavior.
Mm-hmm.
That's all I can do. But aside from that is now I can feedback this information to you, say this is the best I can do, but
mm-hmm.
even I do that, still not enough.
Mm-hmm.
Because those things are defined by the property of these two applications itself.
Exactly.
And then you can say, okay, no, then you can make it.
I agree.
Scheduling decision. You can change your scheduling decision because my high level signal.
I'm just providing a
yeah.
thought,
yeah.
maybe a crazy thought. What you're talking about is one direction of information flow, right? But what if we can provide another direction of information flowing from?
So,
yes.
That's. No, first of all, it's if it's floating point or integer point, then you certainly depend on my feedback to you because you don't.
I agree.
Right?
I'm just saying
and
that.
Second thing, I think what works is like if you what works is if you like to check the phase change of the program, depend on the cache miss, for example. Because cache miss has a very significant impact on the performance.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think from the hardware point of view is our difficulty level, our difficulty or our constraint is we cannot run complex machine learning algorithms
mm-hmm.
from the hardware point of view.
Mm-hmm.
But then you can run it from a system point of view, or system level point of view. And
you
then you can provide this, for example, you provide I don't construct the model, you construct the model. But once you construct a model, you can fit this model to me because all I need is using your existing model and plugging the number in the division.
Right, but I'm just trying to imagine what kind of questions you would like this model to answer.
What kind of questions?
Why do you want to detect phase, first of all?
First of all, okay.
Right.
Very simple is if how do you increase the overall it's all about throughput and then throughput is related with pipeline resource utilization. And what happening is when you have a level 2 cache miss rate, then we categorize with what we call long latency instruction, because it won't come back in a short period of time. And then because of the data dependencies, then all those instructions will stay, all the cache miss instruction and all the dependency instructions will occupy the resources in the pipeline.
Mm-hmm.
Then what happens is you kind of decrease the resources for the other thread who doesn't have level 2 cache miss rate to progress. So you reduce your resource utilization efficiency, and you reduce your throughput.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you can correctly detect the phase change,
okay.
So I know that you are going through a heavy cache miss phase.
Mm-hmm.
In that way, I shouldn't actively execute based on even in this simultaneous multi-threading case.
Mm-hmm.
I should execute the other one who are supposing the complementary phase with less cache miss.
Mm-hmm.
Until your phase changes, then I can adjust. So that always be a research direction in simultaneous multi-threading architecture.
Mm-hmm.
Is the fetch policy. The fetch
mm-hmm.
policy, which means which instruction to from which thread we fetch instructions and then we execute.
But it sounds a little complex to me, because the software has to inform you ahead of time that there is going to be a phase change. Because if the phase change already happened, in the middle of the phase change, you already occupy the pipeline, right? By fetching instructions from the phase.
So your phase is very long.
Right, sorry. What I mean is that you already occupied instructions from phase change instructions, right, when there is a phase change. So the OS has to let the hardware know before the phase change occurs, so as to fill the pipeline with instructions that are going to occupy the pipeline. Right? And so the hint from the OS has to come before the phase change, so that you can adapt the fetch policy accordingly.
But you know that a fetch policy happens at every cycle.
Right. Exactly.
Fetch policy happens at every cycle. That's why we don't have the luxury to run complex algorithms.
But all I'm saying is that the hint from the OS has to come before the phase change.
Not necessarily. Oh, right after it changes.
After it changes, the pipeline is already occupied, because you would fetch instructions from that.
But the phase is very long, right?
The phase change. I'm talking about before the phase changes. The hint has to come from the OS.
Say suddenly the phase becomes a highly cache miss. I don't know how to call it.
Mm.
How highly cache intensive, and it's gonna run for half an hour or
the
whatever.
Phase change?
No, the phase itself.
Oh, the phase, yes.
Right.
The phase is long. Yeah.
Right.
So
if we can detect the change of the phase.
You're talking about a high cache miss rate phase.
Right.
The cache miss rate goes high specifically when the phase changes from one phase to the other phase.
Mm.
And which is a...
But after that it can still be very high.
It could be in a high cache miss phase.
Yes.
If possible.
Yes.
But what I think Chen is talking about is during the phase change, we know for sure that there's going to be a lot of cache miss.
Are you talking about that, or are you talking about the phase itself or the phase change?
No, I think I get what Raju tried to say, because but the thing is, in the real world, when you detect, how do you, if you are in a low cache miss rate phase, how can you predict that you are coming to a high cache phase change? You won't until that happens.
That's exactly what I was saying. Which means that you're not talking about what I'm
talking about.
So you're talking about high cache miss phase.
Yeah.
Not the phase change. Okay. High cache miss phase. It's a high cache miss phase, you can detect that too, because you can see that a certain fetch policy is not working, but it's occupying the cache, occupying the resources. And you can do that dynamically.
I could.
By looking at what's being used. Just by looking at the fact that a certain thread, a certain process is occupying processor resource, pipeline resource for a long period of time and not just looking by the...
That's what I have. That's from hardware point of view, I have difficulty with, because how do I store all those information over a long period of time? I only store information from very short period of time. So that's why from hardware point of view, maybe you cannot see it's a phase change of, it's just a spike. But from the software point of view, you can continuously monitor over a long period of time so that you have better information than what I can see. So that's what I mean.
I see. Okay, yeah, I mean, if the software can help tell you about the phase change, and say that, okay, now there is a phase change, the software can possibly also tell you that, well, this phase is a high cache miss rate
phase.
By just looking at L2 misses.
Yeah.
But all of that, you're saying, cannot be done in hardware.
I mean, correctly detect those phase changes, it's very difficult to do it in the hardware.
What is the impact? So the fetch policy is shown to be really important to impact throughput. And you're saying that all of this to change, dynamically adapt the fetch policy. Right?
Yeah, because fetch policy defines the input to the pipeline.
Right, so it would be good to actually have some reference in the proposal to say, okay, based on this work, they have shown that, you know, the fetch policy for high cache miss rate phases can have a substantial impact on the performance.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
That's very easy to find because
we are making a case for downward communication of information from the virtual machine monitor into the hardware.
Yeah.
Right? The virtual machine monitor detects that.
Very good.
Yeah, I read a couple of things.
Okay, sorry, I got
go. Yeah,
I've class at
Oh, you're already late.
I added another goal to the hinting and also the second research challenge in the hardware section. So maybe you can take a look. This is about how you would summarize information.
Okay.
This is the upward flow for information from the hardware.
Okay. Please go.
That's it.
Are
we meeting next month? Is that what we schedule?
Yes, Monday. Yeah.
Monday at what
time? Monday, I believe it's in the morning, I think.
Mm. Morning.
It's 9:30, I think.
Oh,
9:30 to 11. We have a meeting at 11.
Okay, yeah.
Okay. So all those discussions, I'm not sure how close related that is with the theme of this proposal. I don't know how important
those optimizations would be.
Yeah, the role of the hardware, at least the optimization that could be done in hardware. So maybe the, what do we really need is the information from hardware, right?
That might be the easier one.
Right.
I think sending information to the hardware and changing the hardware, because in a systems proposal, if people want to see a real test,
right,
at the end of the proposal, they want to see how you're going to evaluate all what you're proposing.
Yeah.
And to evaluate some hardware change is going to be really hard.
Well, we could, since Chen is on the board, we could say, I think we can judge for that. He has expertise in simulation at FPGA, so we could justify that, if the idea is good. But the things, I don't know how good the idea is or not. Okay.
It seems like a reasonable direction, which is if the fetch policy is going to matter substantially, then it makes sense to use additional information to improve that fetch policy.
How important that is to a virtual machine system?
I guess it all depends on the workload.
I think there's a paper I once read. This paper from James Smith.
Who's James Smith?
He's the guy that wrote the he's the co-designed the virtual machine. He wrote that virtual machine textbook.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, he's Wisconsin, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he's one pioneer in virtual machine research, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So what he's proposing is basically a virtual private machine. Basically, if you can isolate everything, across virtual machines, then that certainly makes it a much better platform for performance predictions, performance guarantees.
Well, if you accelerate.
Isolate.
isolate.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Each virtual machine has its private processors, caches, memory, bandwidth, etc. Memory. And
Okay. That there is no sharing between two virtual machines.
Right. So this is shared hardware. Right.
Yeah.
Digital resources. But somehow we allocate all of them across the virtual machines and isolate them.
So you isolate the physical hardware.
Yeah. Yeah. So like for shared cache, right, there's already people that are starting how to partition the cache. Right. Alvarado is doing that simulator.
Right.
So this is along that line. That seems to me is more relevant to virtual machine.
But I mean all of this, the effectiveness of something like this depends on the workload. So if I have, let's say, the second virtual machine idle after a while, you probably want to use those resources.
Yes.
So
I agree, but then you can, well, if this can be dynamically allocated. But the point is you have a way to isolate it. You have a way to partition them. Right now, the problem that why we still have all those contention, the contention interference, causing interference,
mm-hmm.
is because there's no strong isolation.
Mm-hmm. Right. Hmm. I see. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, this does make sense, but there's a lot of questions that need to be answered. If you talk about isolation, it's good for some workloads, maybe not so good for other workloads, other sets of virtual machines, where there is no sharing within a single virtual machine across multiple threads, then it doesn't really matter where you put them. But typically, there would be some sharing. I mean, even within the guest OS, across multiple threads, there are shared data structures. So even if there are multiple application threads that do not share application-level information, when the threads enter the kernel, they might share kernel data structures. And that could be an issue. That's what the Corey paper talked about.
Oh, so you're talking about the sharing at the virtual machine mark level?
Sharing inside the guest OS across multiple threads, guest data.
Uh-huh.
Right? So if I have two application level threads inside a single guest and both threads enter the kernel and they manipulate kernel data structures and they share those data structures because they're a single kernel instance, single guest kernel instance.
But that's at a different level. Right, that's inside of the virtual machine.
Sure.
Right.
Yeah.
I think the point here is that if we can partition the hardware resources across virtual machines, then the virtual machine's performance becomes predictable.
Right.
Right.
It becomes predictable, but not necessarily the best.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah,
the isolation of performance guarantees certain performance, but may not be the best performance you can get. So here in this case, you have two processors. If you have, let's say, two threads within a guest, although they might not share application-level data, they may share data inside the kernel. Right? They probably would. Say they open files, they share the file descriptor table, and then they contend on the same shared lock to manipulate the file descriptor table inside the guest OS.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So there it makes sense to put them on the same piece of shared L2 cache because then the locks do not have to incur cache coherence misses and things like that.
I agree, but that's complementary to this, right? That does not conflict with this.
Because it's not conflict, no,
right,
not
right.
at all.
Right.
It would work very well in this situation.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay. That would be like a further optimization on top of this.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Agree.
So, yeah, I'm just saying this could be something that interesting from hardware point of view, although this is...
Quality of service, yeah.
Yeah, although this is already proposed.
I think that we could certainly include quality of service as part of the set of goals that we want to target.
What is the... If quality of service is not the goal, what is the goal?
The goal would be throughput.
Mm.
Say, do the most and the... with the least amount of resources, right? Given the same amount of resources, do more.
Yeah.
But there could be other goals, I agree. I mean, what we are talking about so far, I mean, in my view, it's all about matching the right things together so that you can get the best performance for everything.
Yeah. But that's also implicit to impact the application's performance, right?
If you want QoS, for instance, you want to maybe give a dedicated L2 cache.
but you want to share, but at the same time do not have a significant impact to the performance, right?
Even for your paper, you don't want to put two applications that have high attach mystery at the same core, right?
Mm-hmm.
That was significantly impact their performance, right?
Right. But what I'm saying is that the in whatever we are talking about, the NEQOS guarantees is implicit. We haven't explicitly talked about yet about QoS guarantees because then we have to specify QoS, what it is that we are guaranteeing.
Maybe not guarantee, but optimize performance, just to optimize performance.
Which is throughput. I view it as throughput optimization as opposed to a strict QoS optimization.
I see.
But maybe it makes sense to do QoS too, in addition. I'm just concerned that a reader might get more confused.
I don't want too much things in the pod, no. For QoS, you need strong isolation, and we don't have that. We haven't touched that yet. I agree with that. Yeah, throughput optimization would be the objective. So I know you talked about timeline. Before that, I want to share this with you.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a paper I read last year.
Okay.
Yeah, it's also about virtual machine on medical platform. I think this is a project that was founded last year, or maybe the year before last year.
Dimitrios Nikolopoulos. Sounds familiar, the name.
Mm-hmm. The idea is to use a parallel transition to optimize virtual machine systems on medical platform. And they're proposing different different things, scheduling different things like application specific core configuration, application specific scheduling, application specific guest domain customization, etc. It's a closely related to what we are proposing. But I don't think they touch anything specific to hardware like what we are doing.
Mm-hmm.
There are still many from a software point of view. But they are certainly considering mapping. Okay.
Right. Mapping considering the hardware conflicts?
Yes. Considering the hardware
contention.
Yeah, or behaviors or whatever.
Yeah. But what kind of how do they model hardware resource utilization, or do they?
I don't know the details of the proposal because I haven't read the proposal. I only read the abstract, and this position paper has more information than the abstract. I think.
They got a proposal funded. Yeah. NSF.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So which is a direct competition, right? With what we need to propose. Right.
Well, you don't have to worry about funded proposals. You just have to worry about published papers.
But the idea has to be substantially different than their idea.
In this paper, yes. Not in the proposal, right? We don't know what else is they have.
This is the position paper of the whole proposal.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we have to be distinct from
this,
certainly.
Yes.
So I can read this and give you my thoughts.
Yeah.
Okay. Application-specific operating systems. They're talking about application-specific operating systems, which
I think this part is about the mapping. I think, if I remember correctly.
Hmm.
You can read it.
There's not much data though
in that position paper.
Hmm.
So I don't know what is that. Anyway.
I think we can use some of the data that we looked at today, including some data from the.
Right.
The ESS paper to motivate why the mapping is critical, that doing the right mapping is critical.
Yeah. We certainly have a lot of stuff in the middleware layer, but it's still not very clear to me how to partition the work. What could be the different sections that can
can we can talk about from you know individual idea.
In the middleware layer, right?
So we have modeling, right? You see modeling at the and the you know modeling and with the hardware behaviors right, in mind, especially in mind, that kind of modeling. That's pretty much what your paper is about, right? And also the paper that I'm writing now is about.
Right. And so in terms of, your question is in terms of structuring the proposal.
Yep.
I like the three layers. I like that. There's certainly some feedback between the first and the third layer, maybe even between the second and third layer, so we'll have to worry a little bit about the forward versus backward references to different points of the proposal.
I'm not sure that we have enough meat for each layer. Okay, we have a lot in the middleware layer. I may be able to find some for the virtual machine margin layer. And the hardware layer, I don't know. I'm really not certain about hardware layer.
Even if the hardware layer is just about exposing information, I think that can be quite a bit of information. I mean, quite a bit of material there.
I think, So we could say that you need to be the more information that can be provided from the hardware layer, the better we can do modeling and optimization at the software, right? And then we could use simulator or FPGA to evaluate those effectiveness of those information, that kind of information, right? That can still fall into the third layer, even though it's strongly connected to the middleware layer. That seems to be okay.
There's some tricks we'll have to play with the. With the ordering of these different layers, because if you had to do it the right way, the hardware layer should come first, because then that provides all the information, and then maybe either the hypervisor layer or the middleware layer, which uses some of that information and does other things.
Could be.
Or we could have the middleware layer up front and then say that we're going to use all of this information, but how we collect such information and expose some information is addressed in later in the proposal.
I think maybe in middleware layer we could just propose the general modeling approach, right? That's basically what we are doing, right? General modeling approach. And we use existing results, preliminary results and the preliminary work and the motivation for doing that, right? And then we'll basically focus discussion on how to do the modeling. Given, we can make it generic, given this and that hardware information, and we will do a modeling like this, right? Using this or that approach, right? And then at the end, we could say that this hardware information that we're talking about here, some of them is already available, right? And some of them still need to be provided by the hardware. And we'll talk about, we'll discuss them in the hardware layer. Right? That could apply too.
I think the strongest part of the proposal should probably come up front.
Absolutely.
So I would recommend to create an SVN repository in an initial
some skeleton and which we can start filling in.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I think this direction of information flow, I think I feel pretty comfortable with that. Mm-hmm. But the feedback into the hardware, I don't know. And the machine learning idea, I'm not so sure about that either. Yeah. So, I think in terms of timeline, it would be ideal if we can have a, say, 60 to 80% complete draft by the end of this month.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so we have pretty much 2 weeks to work on it.
Yeah.
I'll be able to complete dedicate myself on this proposal after this week, comes Friday, basically. Okay, before Friday, I have to work on that paper. Right?
Yeah.
And that paper can be, certainly can be used in this proposal.
Okay.
So we have about 2 weeks for the draft. And then the first week, which is the week before you leave, right, also before macro, then we could iterate on the
draft. Micro.
Yeah.
Oh, before micro.
Yeah. Right. So basically before the end of the first week of December, right, we could iterate, we can work together on the draft and revise it. And then after the first week, depending on how much time you and Chen can contribute, you guys can help me to, you know, to continue, you know, polishing the paper, right?
I can certainly give you some feedback remotely.
Mm.
Yeah. And at that stage, I think it's also important to have one person doing sort of setting the tone of the proposal, because if different people start adding things at random, the proposals start falling apart quickly.
Right.
I don't know if you remember, but during when we did the
other
proposal, I made sure that I had complete control towards the end of the...
I agree, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's really important.
I think particularly for SVM-based collaboration, it has to be
yeah.
If it's a word, it can, you can still insert comments here and there. And
yeah,
but SVM is more tricky. Yeah, I agree, yeah. So if we basically by the end of this month maybe 60% is can be done, and by the end of the first week of December 80% or 90%.
Yeah, I mean comments are always useful, right? But in terms of primary editing,
it's better
to have one person.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, but on Word you can try changes. On SV is tricky.
Even so, in Word, I mean, you just go back and just revert the change of the other person. It's a mess. I mean, you spend more time that way.
It's
better to just collect the comments and do it yourself.
If before you leave, before Chen leaves, we can finish 80 to 90% of the proposal. That should be. We will be in a good shape.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think we can.
Yeah.
I think we have, at least in terms of material, we have enough material to write most of it.
Okay.
Right. And then, of course, there are all the other minor logistical things, like the budget and the other broader impact and educational stuff and all of that.
Yeah.
I think that can
only
be later on, at the last moment.
That should be easy. Okay. I think I can create an outline during the weekend. Okay, but before that, maybe we should continue to brainstorming using the Google Doc. We can read all the papers that are relevant, right? That's something we need to do anyway, right? We read the papers and then you continue freshing out the ideas. And then, let's say before we meet on Monday, we should have online. And I can do an initial task assignment.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And on Monday when we meet on Monday morning, we can finalize the assignment and then we can start to write.
Okay.
The other thing I want to talk about to you is.
Is it related to the proposal?
Yeah.
Okay.
If we say that we want to use VMware for prototyping, do you think we can get the support from RJ? I don't know how much help that will be.
Uh, we can get a support letter to Monday. That's not going to be difficult.
Yeah, that will be.
But, I mean, we don't really need a support letter because we already have source access. Did you go through that process already?
I did. You already have source
access. Yeah, I have source access. Yeah.
Mm.
So we're planning to use that for one of our ESX for one of our other projects.
So did you get the rest of the whole source code?
Yeah.
That's just part of it, the whole source code.
To ESX, yeah.
Okay.
To the ESX source.
Mm. How complicated
and
is
workstation.
That? How complicated is that?
Not at all.
Not at all?
No. I just had to sign in one
place. No, I mean, how many lines of code?
I haven't looked at it.
I was curious.
And very likely, I won't look at it. So these are two
weeks. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I haven't done that yet. So I feel at this stage, it is still sufficient for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to do something using parallel transition. So then I feel better at this stage. Yeah. Yeah. But I would like to take a look at
it. If we want some support letter from Ajay to say that this general direction actually makes sense. I think that's possible.
Yeah. And while we could still say that...
And he's already collaborating with us.
Yes. And I think he's certainly more expert on VMware than we are.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So he could provide advice on how to implement what we are proposing on VMware, right?
Absolutely.
If you think that makes sense. Okay.
I think it does. Yeah.
Okay.
I think in terms of collaboration, he's already collaborating.
Right.
And we can add him as a collaborator on this proposal. Yeah.
Great. So if you could just mention this to him at some point in time, and later when we have a draft with you, send it also for his feedback, but this could help too.
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay. So I think after I go home, I put this timeline on the Google Doc. Okay, and then we should continue to use that to collaborate.
Yeah.
And hopefully by the end of this, before Monday, you have the SPN and the online, NetX online.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, if you probably have already access to some other LaTeX based proposals, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean,
yours and the JS.
Yes.
Yeah. I can just use your template. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess I can just use yours. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Okay. Sounds good. And I'll send you the papers on the